At Farm to Table, we know how confusing healthcare is. We're here to simplify the healing process. We believe that healthcare should be simple. It should help people feel better. That's why we started the Table Talk podcast, to gather around the table with you, no matter where you are. We want to come and learn together and discuss a new healthcare approach that addresses the root cause of your symptoms. The journey for each person is unique, but together we can thrive. All right. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast. I'm so excited today because we get to talk to, I would say she's famous within the functional medicine community, but Dr. Carrie Jones is with us and particularly famous for hormones. And so today we're going to dive into menopause. So I'm just going to give you a little background on Dr. Jones. So she's a naturopathic physician who also has a master's in public health and is an internationally recognized speaker, consultant, educator on the topic of women's health and hormones. Dr. Jones graduated from National University of Natural Medicine in Portland, Oregon, and then completed a two-year residency in women's health, hormones, and endocrinology. She also later graduated from Grand Canyon University's Master of Public Health program and one of the first to become board certified through the American Board of Naturopathic Endocrinology and currently serves on that board. She was the medical director for the Dutch test with Precision Analytical for several years and is a clinical expert for the SOS Stress Recovery Program for Lifestyle Matrix Resource Center and is currently on the Under Armour Council of Human Performance and currently serves as the head of medical education at Rupa Health. So welcome, Dr. Jones. And she is also a podcaster. So she has a podcast called Root Cause Medicine. So we'll make sure that we link that in the show notes as well. So welcome to the podcast today. And just to kick it off, why don't you tell us, so I know you focus a lot on women's health and hormones, and certainly menopause is a big topic when women are approaching that age. So tell us a little bit about what menopause is and at what symptoms that people may be experiencing, sort of what's happening at this time.
It can feel like chaos. It can feel like chaos for a lot of women, right? So first of all, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it and love always talking about hormones, especially for women who are perimenopausal and menopausal, because I feel as we get away from our 20s and 30s, not much education goes out there with our OBGYN or our primary care or really anything in school. You know, we were taught years ago how to either get or avoid being pregnant. And beyond that, it was like, best of luck. You know, changes are going to happen, but we're not going to talk about it. And I found through the years that a lot of my patients would hit their 40s and go, what is happening to me? I haven't changed anything. I didn't change my habits. I haven't changed my diet. I haven't changed my exercise routine. I take the same supplements and medications, but yet I feel all these crazy symptoms. So my periods are starting to change. They're getting shorter or they're getting longer. They're coming more often or they're skipping months. I'm having some more hot flashes and night sweats. So like my temperature regulation is off. I'm noticing my brain function isn't as swift and sharp as it used to be. I'm, you know, can't remember words. I go into a room, I've lost my keys, which is so not like me. You know, and people start to notice the sort of systemic physical symptoms. Like my joints are a little more achy and, you know, my libido has definitely gone away. And, you know, my hair is starting to feel dry and brittle. Like, what is happening? Like, well, welcome to perimenopause. Perimenopause is the transition, the transition into full menopause. So full menopause is when you go 12 months with no period, so no menstrual cycle, age-related. So if you're listening to this and you're like, well, I'm 24 and I haven't had a period in 12 months, like that's different. That's not menopause. Menopause is when we sort
we
of
have another podcast for
we
that.
Have not, yeah, we have exactly. But if you were in your, you know, 40s and 50s and you haven't had a period in 12 months, that's the definition. Once you hit the 13th month of no period, you are considered menopausal. It doesn't mean the symptoms go away. Sadly, they don't go hand in hand, but that is the classical definition. So we have the transition period, perimenopause, and then no period, and that's menopause.
And we also have that group that's surgically put into menopause by a hysterectomy and removal of the ovaries. And that's a whole nother situation as well,
that's
because we don't get quite the slow transition.
Yes. Yeah. And those women I feel so bad for, because I would have patients say, okay, I'm having my hysterectomy complete, right? Ovaries as well, which is will put you into full surgical menopause. And I'd say, okay, just be aware when you wake up from surgery, the minute the ovaries are removed, you are considered menopausal. The second. It's not a slow decline.
Right.
It's not like you get a month or a week, or maybe through the weekend, it's immediate. So when you wake up from surgery, you are going to be considered menopausal. And it's so unfair and so unfortunate, even in a necessary situation. I'm not against a full hysterectomy. Sure. If you need it, get it. But I don't think the education is there, where sometimes they are left with nothing. Sometimes they have an estrogen patch slapped on them and they're like, go follow up with your OBGYN. And sometimes, you know, it can be just awful. And I wish more education was out there for them as well.
Sure, sure. Because I think that population too, I think traditional, like you said, the OBGYNs will prescribe an estrogen patch, but then like all the benefits of progesterone, if you're talking to like a 30-year-old person, it's like, okay, like I know you don't have a uterus anymore, so we don't need to protect the endometrial lining, but there's so many other things that progesterone does in the body. And I realize there's probably a lack of evidence and use in that population, you know, from a large study, you know, group population, but it's definitely conversations that are worth having with people's providers for sure.
I agree.
Yeah. So as far as those symptoms, and from my background, I see a lot of like metabolic patients with diabetes, and in this menopausal period, because of this decrease in estrogen, they start to have a rise in their blood sugars. So we see more weight gain. Like you said, like the foods that they were eating aren't working anymore. The diet that they were doing, or the nutrition program, exercise program that they were doing, isn't working anymore. So that can become a challenge. But what do you recommend nutrition wise for this group of people? And we'll get into HRT or hormone replacement in a minute, but what is like sort of, is there research around, you know, what's the best diet? I know we have like a million different diet options. I was just talking to my students this morning about the keto diet and how that's probably not long standing, or like as far as keeping it for forever, you know, it's probably not sustainable. But what do you see, or what do you recommend to your patients that are like, okay, what do I eat, and how do I improve my nutrition at this point?
There's kind of two categories for this. There's the person who never had to worry about their weight, and so they literally ate whatever they wanted most of their life. And now as they head into menopause, they are noticing they cannot get away with the junk, the snacking, their choices when it comes to their metabolic health, or the like that visceral body fat that they're putting on around the middle, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So for them, I'm like, hey, it's a real wake-up call. The choices that you're making, either the fried, the fast, the high sugar, the processed, the chemical additives, like we have to really clean that up. So that's one camp where we have to start with sort of the basics of nutrition. Now there's another camp who are already really pretty educated. They definitely do generally eat a clean diet. They tend to lean towards vegetables. They eat their protein. But what I'm finding, and what I've learned a lot from another doctor, Dr. Gabrielle Lyon, is that as we get older, we need a whole lot more protein. In fact, Dr. Stacey Sims, who's a researcher, women's health researcher, she talks about this all the time as well. As we get older, our protein need goes up. And what I would find in practice is that that camp of women who tended to eat, quote unquote, cleaner, they didn't eat enough. I mean, they were having a salad with a little bit of chicken on top and thinking, you know, well, I got my vegetables and some protein. And I'm like, oh my gosh, we need to get a little more substance in there. We probably need to double, if not triple, the protein, depending on how much you've got. And then being aware of timing of foods, especially because sometimes we think we're eating really clean, but we end up finding that we're actually really snacking all the time. We're constantly grabbing and nibbling and noshing and sipping and drinking like all through the day, which can affect our blood sugar and insulin, of course. And then we get into perimenopause and menopause, which makes us more unstable in the metabolic area and more prone to things like prediabetes, diabetes, insulin resistance, et cetera. And so it really is truly, I find for a lot of women, is like, let's evaluate the facts. What are you actually eating? How often are you actually eating it? Not what you think, but like, you know, like, let's be real about this. Coupled with things we don't even think about, alcohol intake. You know, women will say, oh, I don't drink that often. But when they actually look at their intake over a week or even a month, they find, oh my gosh, I'm actually drinking a lot more alcohol than I thought. Or coffee drinks. How often do you drink coffee drinks? Oh, not that often. But then they realize they're picking up fancy sugar-filled, foam-topped coffee drink 4 or 5 times a week, you know. And so by truthfully looking at the facts to help evaluate. But I will go back to what Dr. Lyon and Dr. Sims say, is that I think as women get older, our protein need for sure goes up. I, for one, I'm in my 40s. I have drastically increased my protein intake. I thought I ate a lot of protein before. I was wrong when I did the math and really looked at my foods. And by just increasing my protein, however that looked, has made a massive difference in my energy, in my cravings or my hunger or just my body in general. Sure. And so while I know there are a lot of diets out there, I mean, there's everything from vegan, vegetarian, all the way up to, you know, paleo and carnivore. I find that
eating only meat.
Oh my gosh, only meat. Exactly. And, you know, in some cases they have a place or they have a timeline, sure, depending what's going on in your body. But I do agree more protein is better. I do agree we have to be very mindful of the snacking, the alcohol, the sugar, the coffee drinks. So I try to take it back to those basics as opposed to saying, oh my gosh, everybody needs paleo once they hit perimenopause. Like, maybe, but maybe not. Maybe that's not what works for you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe if you're autoimmune or have gut dysfunction and like there's other things layered on top of that, and some of those dates, I guess we could say. What are your thoughts on intermittent fasting in this population? Because I go back to at least what I've looked at, a lot of these patients in these studies are men, intermittent fasting data. But then also, like, we have these other studies that sort of throw me off because they're like a nurse's health study where like skipping breakfast, like decreased their GLP-1 response at lunch and like actually made them have higher glucose levels at lunch. And so like, how do you balance that conversation? Because I do see some women that it works for, but then other women that it doesn't seem to make a difference. Because I have people with diabetes tell me a lot of time, oh, I never eat breakfast. And I'm just like, if all these people aren't eating breakfast, clearly this intermittent fasting thing isn't working. So, so what are your thoughts on that?
I'm not against it at all. And in fact, you know, two of the big women's health intermittent fasting experts, Dr. Mindy Pills and then Cynthia Thurlow, were good friends of mine. And so I love hearing what they do with their thousands of women as they're leading them through these protocols. And of course, Cynthia and Mindy are also both menopausal. And so they have a lot of personal experience as well and can lead groups through that. So I agree with you. I find I have a lot of women that comment or DM me, you know, that say that in this transition, they have decided to work with intermittent fasting because they used to eat all day long from the time they got up to the time they went to the bed when they were, you know, watching Netflix at night and snacking all night long. And when they implemented intermittent fasting, it really helped them get control over their eating window. Because of course, intermittent fasting doesn't necessarily mean you lower your calorie intake. It's just you shorten your eating window, so you have a longer time where you don't eat. And for a lot of women, they would say, oh my gosh, that was very helpful for me to see how often was I snacking, why constantly reaching for something, the cravings that I had. So it really actually made them more aware of their body. Whereas others thought that intermittent fasting was too much, too hard, maybe with cortisol response, you know, maybe the stress in their life, maybe gut health, that when they would try to ease into intermittent fasting, or though some women just jump right into it and go 16 hours, do the 16-8 plan, and they're like, I felt horrible. I'm like, maybe we should ease into that and start with 12. 12-12. Yeah. And so then in that case, I'm like, well, let's evaluate what else is going on. How is your cortisol? How is your thyroid? How is your gut health? Yeah. And so I agree with you. I'm all for it if it's going to work. If somebody says I'd like to try it, I'm like, fantastic. I recommend you pick up Mindy's book or Cynthia's book and don't do it blindly. And if it doesn't work, don't give up hope. There's probably other reasons, and let's address that.
Yeah. Yeah, we can link those books in the show notes too. I think that's interesting because I feel like in a perfect world, intermittent fasting would really skip dinner instead of breakfast. But our American like society is so like dinner is our family time. So it's really hard to, I mean, I think in Europe it might be easier because they have that. I mean, obviously they're becoming a little westernized too with like the schedule, but in general, they still have their bigger meal at lunchtime. So I think that might make it easier because then you just have a cup of tea or something when you get home and not have to feel like you need to get all of your calories from that day. But yeah, so super interesting. And I'll have to read those books myself as I start to help more people in that age range. But as far as HRT, so let's talk about, I am completing my fellowship with A4M, and a lot of that includes the endocrine module specifically focused on hormones and hormone replacement therapy. And the more I learn about the role of estrogen and progesterone, I'm like, oh my goodness, like as soon as I'm like low, I need to like get this, right? but then we have like modern medicine that's like, no, we only give this for certain situations, or we have this past study with the Women's Health Initiative that sort of like almost like screwed the current generation of, yeah, you know, women that were not as educated from the provider level because we were taught this information. So tell us a little bit about that and sort of what the problems were with that study and sort of where we are now with hormone replacement therapy.
Oh my goodness. The Women's Health Initiative, the WHI. So the WHI came out to evaluate estrogen and progestin, which is not progesterone, but progestin, mm-hmm, from a few different angles. So they had a group that was estrogen only, and they had a group that was the estrogen progestin. So essentially the brand name of the medication was Prempro, Premarin and Provera. And so many women were on this for menopause to help their brain, their bones, their symptoms, their sex life, etc. So the Women's Health Initiative came out and it made front headlines all over the world, essentially, that said, you know, these hormones cause breast cancer, including other things. It negatively affected your brain, negatively affected your colon, plus others. And so hormone replacement therapy came to a screeching halt. And women who were doing really well on it were all of a sudden yanked off of it, plunged into worse symptoms, and it became a nightmare. Well, since that time, a lot of drama. It should be a mini series. If it isn't yet, and I've just missed it.
Yeah.
So the Women's Health Initiative, when you read the story behind the authors when they signed off on it, I mean, it's even things like they were put in a room and they were forced to sign off on the study and the outcomes. And many of the authors disagreed with it. And it was like, you don't have a choice. Like, they were publishing, it's going to the paper in 10 minutes, or, you know, like, if your name's on, your name has to be on this paper, you have to sign off on this. All the way to so many retractions. A lot of authors have gone on to do additional studies, additional follow-ups. And while it never made the news, not ever, you know, you will read follow-up studies by various authors who were on the original study. And basically, without saying, oops, that was a mistake, it was, oops, that was a mistake. Like, that's actually not true, what came out of the Women's Health Initiative. Sure. And the Women's Health Initiative itself had a really poor design. It was older women, a lot of metabolic conditions, smokers, that increased the risk for some of the outcomes that they found in the Women's Health Initiative already. And they excluded women. They were very careful in who they included to get the outcome that they wanted for some of their studies on, like, hot flashes or quality of life. There are a few branches of the Women's Health Initiative. Cancer was not the only outcome they looked at. So they were very careful to exclude women who would skew the results or make it seem better than it actually was, which we all found out, you know, a decade later, unfortunately.
Sure. Yeah.
And so when you read the studies, I mean, even the estrogen that they used, the Premarin that they used, it didn't raise breast cancer at all. It was just wild when you just, estrogen by itself, you know, is not the issue. But as a result, because of the news and because everyone now who goes to a pharmacy, as you know, if you get any type of estrogen product, and even if you just get bioidentical progesterone, which is Prometrium, from the pharmacy, or you get the insert, the package insert, and it's like, oh, because of the WHI, this is going to cause cancer, so good luck. And then my patients freak out. The insert says it causes cancer. I'm like, oh, we are so behind the times in the pharmacy world of printing this out. And so while I don't think, I mean, estrogen is not perfect, it got vilified, and 100%, 100% the blame for breast cancer. And now, slowly but surely, we have learned estrogen single-handedly by itself is not the cause of breast cancer. I mean, cancer is a complicated, multifaceted thing that happens in our body. I mean, there are a lot of reasons and things that have to go wrong or build up for us to develop cancer. Everything from genetics, and I don't even mean the BRCA gene, the BRCA gene, but I even mean, like, the way we detoxify, like the way we handle estrogen, the way that we process these chemicals, to the chemicals that end up in our body and act like estrogen, to estrogen itself, et cetera, et cetera. And so I understand the fear, the frustration, the nervousness that a lot of women have around, I heard HRT causes cancer. It's like, oh gosh, trying to sum that up in 5 minutes in a patient visit is very hard.
Right.
But we have come, people listening to know, like, oh my gosh, we have come such a long way. We have learned so much. A lot of those authors have actually come out with later studies to show quite the opposite, that the HRT wasn't causing those things. And in fact, can be really quite beneficial all around. And the WHI trial, good gracious, that it's such a disservice to women. Yeah. Because, which we will talk about, I'm not necessarily an advocate for those forms of HRT, Premarin or Provera, the ethanol estradiol or progestin. However, I think it really plunged a lot of women the last couple decades into an awful menopause, metabolic syndrome, sure. potentially dementia, Alzheimer's risk, mm-hmm. osteoporosis. I mean, it just really wreaked havoc on women who had to go off their HRT.
Yeah. And so when you talk about like that study with people that were like, you know, in their 60s and had these cardiovascular risk factors and thinking about like the population that we put on HRT now, from my understanding, we should really be targeting women that have, we could start it as early as perimenopausal if we see those levels drop, but really like within that first 5 years of menopause is really like the golden place to see the outcomes as far as like preserving bone mineral density and, you know, brain function and things like that. So what are your thoughts on when you start that HRT?
Exactly what you said. So the sooner the better. One, you'll get the benefits. And two, as you know, as we get older and lose estrogen, well, you and I know, people listening may not know. So again, we are more at risk for metabolic issues, prediabetes, diabetes, insulin resistance. We are more at risk for cardiovascular stuff, atherosclerosis, things like that. And if you have inflamed arteries, if your arteries are at an atherosclerotic point, estradiol can actually make you a lot worse, and we have to be very careful at that point. Like I said, estrogen is not perfect, but it doesn't need to be as vilified. And that often happens with age, or our risk goes up for that with age. So if you are headed into menopause in your 40s or 50s, that is the ideal time. If you hem and haw and wait, and then you're suddenly you're 65 and you think, gosh, I am still having hot flashes. I still don't sleep well. I'm still having all these symptoms. I'm going to go ahead and talk about my doctor about HRT. Then as you get older, we definitely give it a big old pause of like, I don't know that you're a candidate as much as you were when you were younger. And a lot of the bone, brain, et cetera, changes, you know, it's been probably been 15 years, maybe even 20 if you're looking at this for at 65. And so by then I'm like, you're not going to get your bones back, unfortunately. Like the degradation in your brain, you can do what we can with other ways, but it's not, estrogen is not a magic savior that's going to come in and patch it all back up again. So I agree with you 100%. I think the younger, I joke to my friends, when my friends and I are all around the same age, our mid-40s, and I said, the minute we all need estrogen and progesterone, we're going to prescribe for each other. We are preserving as much as we can.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And so we could talk a little bit about the formulations. Like you mentioned, the formulations that we typically use are different than what was used in the Women Health Initiative. Mm-hmm. So we use bioidentical, which means that it's basically the same chemical that is found, or chemical structure found in the body. Mm-hmm. It may not be created from the body, but it is the same chemical structure. And so those can be given topically, orally, even vaginally for some patients. And so the one sort of nuance, or the nuances I see a lot of, well, there's actually a prescription product now that's oral estrogen and oral progesterone in a tablet that is bioidentical, which I'm like, yay, bioidentical. It's in a, you know, it's in a tablet. But we do see, and I believe it's a little bit of increased risk in clotting in patients
that's
with oral estrogen. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's probably not the most ideal, but
same. Not many practitioners that I know, conventional or functional, use oral estradiol, just flat out, period. Most, if they're going to use a prescription, they'll use the patches. You know, they'll use like, you know, the DOT or something like that, which are also bioidentical.
Right.
And then they will add in the oral progesterone known as Prometrin, if that's the route they're going to go. And I tend to follow that as well. I don't generally use oral estradiol, although I understand why, given some research on it, for the positive effects, I understand why people jump to the oral estradiol.
Yeah, and I feel most comfortable with the standardized forms of estradiol patches and things like you mentioned too, because we know like the data is there for this level to increase by this much, et cetera. There's certainly compounding pharmacies that can like dial it in a little bit if you need less, especially in that perimenopausal phase. You may not need the full dose of estrogen, But I think there's just so many more factors in that, like what creams they used and where the patient puts it when they're rotating spots, and certainly can rub off on somebody else. Mm-hmm. And so they have to, there's lots of like potentials with the topicals, but I know a lot of practitioners are, I mean, I'm using topicals too in some patients, but I think sometimes it's like, okay, if cost is a concern, going with a more conventional like patch route might also be a better place because it's going to be covered on their insurance.
I love that you said that because people will often ask me, just as I'm sure they ask you, Carrie, what's the best? What's the best form? And I'm like, well,
yeah,
you know, or they'll say my sister told me, or I read on social media that topical, you know, creams are the best. And I'm like, except you're in your 40s and, you know, let's say you had children late in life. And so they still like snuggle with you in bed, or, you know, you read with them at night. And so they're all snuggled up against you. So you've got this cream on you, depending when you put it on and which one it is, you know, mm-hmm. and it can transfer and it can transfer to your partner. I mean, it's. These hormones are very, we call them.
Even pets.
Completely. They're very fat soluble, meaning they will pick up very quickly through skin to skin contact. And the same goes for, you know, vaginal. Somebody will say, I've heard vaginal hormone is the best. I said, well, it depends what the outcome is, but you also don't want to use it as a lubrication. So if you are sexually active in any form and you've inserted your hormone up there, then you have to be careful because your partner doesn't need or want that hormone as well, and you have to be very careful. So then I would, you know, so some women are like, oh, that doesn't matter at all to me, and others are like, oh no, we are very active or very spontaneous, that won't work. I'm like, so you can, I'm asking all these questions as to what will work for your lifestyle, and then we can adjust from there, as opposed to quote, what do I think is the best.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a great point. And I think a lot of times in a traditional medical office, like those questions aren't necessarily being asked, or the education isn't there to support like, okay, if you do go with the vaginal, here's, you know, the things you need to think about.
Yeah.
But then the progesterone standpoint, we know that like low progesterone, even in premenopausal women, and lack of progesterone or enough progesterone in the second half of the cycle has been associated with anxiety. So the cool thing is that oral progesterone actually breaks down into metabolites that cause a calming effect. So I had a patient that was a patient with type 2 diabetes, and she was only sleeping like 3 to 4 hours a night. And we were within like 2 years of her being in menopause. And so I said, well, you know, if you're not able to fall asleep or calm down, and obviously the estrogen plays a role in the glucose, and her glucose was all over the place. I talked to her about the benefits of HRT from that perspective. So we tried it. And so we did oral progesterone with the, you know, GABAergic effects from the progesterone metabolites. And then we also did a topical estrogen cream or estradiol cream. And she was sleeping like a baby within like a few weeks.
I love that.
So 7 to 8 hours of sleep after that. Yeah. So it's amazing. I won't say like every single person has that exact picture, but when it happens, you're like, oh my goodness, yay. And then, you know, the blood sugar improvement, is it from the estrogen? Is it from the fact that you slept 7 to 8 hours a night and your body is actually able to like manage your cortisol response better? So I think there's so many pieces of all of that that fits together. So speaking of pieces fitting together, let's talk a little bit about gut health and how important that is. When we're talking about, you know, the Women's Health Initiative and the increased risk of breast cancer, one of the things is making sure that estrogen gets out of the body appropriately. And so talk to us a little bit about estrogen detox, because I think that's like sort of a buzzword that everyone's talking about. And, you know, what are the keys there for women, especially women on HRT?
Yeah, well, and actually, one of the things, I don't know why I didn't think of this, but I was at a conference in 2022, and one of the keynote speakers was talking about is women lose their estradiol, their entire gut microbiome shifts. Like, you have estradiol receptors, you know, pretty much everywhere all over your GI tract as females, well, and males too, but her focus was females. And so she's like, as you move into menopause, the gut you had in a cycling woman is no longer the gut that you have. And I was like, who designed that? Like, who decided? That's terrible, but it also makes sense in that as we move into menopause, our gut health is so important and tied to so many systemic symptoms. And so for those women who say, Carrie, I haven't changed anything, I'm like, but everything has changed internally and you just don't know it. I mean, you know it because you feel it, but you didn't do anything. You lost your estradiol and everything inside changed. So I thought that was super fascinating. So I've been really diving into what is changing when we lose our estradiol. And that goes with estrogen detoxification. So when we talk about detoxification, first of all, it happens 24/7, 365. Your body is detoxifying Right now, every single day, it doesn't take a break for Christmas, Hanukkah, Sunday, your birthday. Detoxification is always happening, right? And you've learned that there are ways you expel stuff from your body. You sweat it out, you breathe it out, you pee it out, your bowel movements. With estrogen in particular, it goes through your liver predominantly, but it can go through other tissues in the body as a first step. And then it goes into your GI tract or it goes into your kidneys. So estrogen doesn't get breathed out or sweated out. So it's really important that we focus on our GI tract for estrogen. And I often refer to our GI tract as like our sewer line. It's the end of the line for getting estrogen out. So we have to make sure our GI tract is healthy. Do you have regular bowel movements? Do you have gas and bloating? Do you have small intestinal bacterial overgrowth? Do you have H. pylori, heartburn, GERD, et cetera? Like, what is going on? Because that's going to negatively impact how you do or don't clear estrogen from your body, which then can negatively impact breast tissue, as an example.
Yeah. That what you said about the estrogen receptors in the gut, I wonder if like that's part of the reason why estrogen can be more dangerous from an atherosclerotic standpoint in someone that has gone so many years without it, if then we're not just like set up to be able to handle it like we were when we were having the constant exposure to estrogen. So I don't know if that's there's any research on that or not. But I would think if you're taking HRT that you, then your gut would still sort of look like
it does
a little bit more like your premenopausal days. Yeah. Yeah, cool. And then who do we think is not a candidate for HRT? Is like there anyone out there that like shouldn't be taking? I mean, certainly people that have had estrogen dependent cancers are probably off the list for HRT, but anyone else, if they have family history of estrogen dependent cancers, like what are your conversations like with those women?
So I absolutely ask them those questions. Have you ever had an estrogen related cancer? Remember, it doesn't have to be breast. It could be uterine or cervical, you know, there's other tissues that are estrogen related. Family history, but it's also how close. If somebody says, well, my great grandmother had it, or, you know, two aunties over had it. I'm like, nope, that isn't. But if your sister had it, mom had it, mom and sister have had it, you know, then I'm a lot more concerned. But I'm concerned in general. I'm not just necessarily concerned about estrogen. I'm like, what is it that we need to help affect, clean up, test that your family is prone to estrogen? And then again, I am cautious with cardiovascular disease. So if you're already coming to me at 40 years old, having had a stent put in, you're on all sorts of high blood pressure, high cholesterol type medications, beta block, like if your cardiologist is really has their thumb on you, I will probably talk to the cardiologist first to say, you know, obviously I wouldn't do oral estrogen, but maybe we ease into it with progesterone. And then maybe we start with some DHEA or testosterone, and then we can, you know, determine what's going on with that estrogen.
Yeah, for sure. That's a good point. Yeah, because earlier and earlier, I mean, I think we see a lot of men that have cardiovascular disease early, but even women now, you know, in those 40s timeframe, unfortunately, are seeing that as well. So if someone couldn't use HRT, or maybe they're past the optimal timeframe for HRT, what are sort of, I mean, besides the nutrition components we talked about, do you have any go-to nutrients or supplements that you like to use in those women?
No, remember, when we talk about HRT, you and I are predominantly talking about estradiol and progesterone. You can still use progesterone, DHEA, testosterone in an older age. It's estradiol predominantly that we're talking about with getting that benefit early on. Yeah. But if you're 65 and need vaginal DHEA or vaginal testosterone or topical testosterone, progesterone for sleep, I'm okay with that for sure. So there are other methods of, or forms, I should say, of HRT hormones, definitely. But let's say you can't use estrogen, what can you use? I mean, there are definitely some really nice herbal blends that help with adrenal. So those adrenal herbal adaptogens to help with stress management, herbs that can help estrogen receptors. We see a lot like with black cohosh or hops or angelica that are supportive to help reduce the risk of hot flashes and night sweats, making sure, again, as we're getting older, making sure we're getting our nutrients, our minerals. We're often very mineral deficient as we get older. Even things like our magnesium, like the most common, make sure you're getting enough magnesium. And so by going back to the basics, what's your vitamin D look like? What do your B vitamins look like? These are all easily testable things. And I would hate to miss them because you're so focused on estrogen or not estrogen, and but you're ragingly anemic, or you're ragingly low in vitamin D. Like, let's address those things, because gosh, that can make a world of difference too.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for joining us today. Tell our audience where they can find you.
Absolutely. You can find me on social media. I am on Instagram at dr.carriejones, or my website, www.drcarriejones.com. Or you, if you are a practitioner listening, rupahealth.com, and you can learn all about Rupa and lab work and even the other education and podcasts that I do there.
Awesome. Yes. And she is on the Root Cause Medicine podcast as well in iTunes and probably other, wherever you listen to podcasts, all the places. It would be nice if there's just one place, but I know no one talks to each other, just like the healthcare system. So many different avenues, but awesome. Thanks so much for joining us again. We really appreciate your time and have a good
Wonderful.
Day.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. We're excited you are on your journey with us. Find us online at farmtotable.life, farm with a P, and on Instagram at farmtotableteam.